KaiserNetwork.org.
Say, gee, I've done my duty and I got a nice tax write-off. If you're not going to...
Please welcome Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Thank you. Good morning, and it's a great honor to be here with all of you. And I have the privilege of announcing commitments before we start our session. And these commitments bring together a variety of partners to address, among other items, the health and economic challenges facing women around the world today. First, I would like to recognize Milan Verveer. Milan is the board chair of Vital Voices Global Partnership, and her partners are Maria Idle, president of the Nike Foundation, Ray Ferguson, CEO of the American Standard Chartered Bank, Sandra Taylor, vice president, corporate social responsibility for Starbucks Coffee Company, and Exxon Mobil. They have committed to holding a conference in January of 2001, making 2007, making a commitment. Yeah, we're going backwards. We're going forwards here. Making a commitment of $1 million to convene a Pan-African Women's Leadership Summit, the purpose of which is to connect more than 200 African women who are working in various roles throughout the continent as leaders for positive change. And this will recognize the critical role that African women play today and must play in moving the continent forward in achieving greater health, welfare, and more stable governments and economies. So thank you very much to Milan Verveer and her partners. Second, I would like to recognize Dr. Zita Rosenberg, CEO of the International Partnership for Microbicides, known as IPM. IPM and its partner, Harvard University and Partners in Health, will commit $3 million over the next 3 years to support access to microbicides for the prevention of HIV transmission and to help develop a broader framework to bring innovative global public health goods to low-resource settings.
Thank you so much.
I would like now to recognize Ajay Banga, Chairman and CEO of Citigroup's Global Consumer Group International. Citigroup will be expanding its programs to support sustainable microfinance institutions by $100 million over 5 years. They're already doing work around the world, but this is a significant increase in their commitment. And I appreciate very much Citigroup and Ajay Banga, who we'll meet in a minute because he's on the panel. Finally, I would like to recognize Dr. Alan Rosenfield. Those of us in public health work or who have supported the soldiers on the front lines of public health know this name very well. Dr. Rosenfield is the Dean of the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. He is also one of the pioneers in working on behalf of maternal health around the world and was one of the people who understood early that we had to stop the transmission of HIV/AIDS from mothers to children if we would ever have any hope of getting the epidemic under control. The Mailman School will be making a five-year, $75 million commitment to help improve women's health, decrease maternal death and disability, provide prevention care and treatment for women infected with HIV/AIDS, and decrease the incidence of violence against women in conflict areas. Thank you, Dr. Rosenfield. should give another round of applause for all those commitments. They're really significant efforts to deal with many of the issues affecting women, and that's part of the reason we wanted to have a special plenary session on women and the power of economic opportunity. A little over a decade ago, I had the honor of leading the American delegation to the 4th United Nations Conference on Women in Beijing. The outcome of that conference was a platform for action where we proudly declared that women's rights were human rights and human rights were women's rights. And we knew that that message had to be repeated over and over again. While in Beijing, I was inspired by the stories of women from so many parts of the world who, when given the opportunity, were able to take control of their lives and become economically self-sufficient, benefiting not only themselves, but their families and their local communities. Time and again, microfinance and microcredit organizations have been shown to be successful tools at lifting women and their families out of poverty. They give individuals the ability to move beyond subsistence living, to send their children to school where that still is a costly barrier. They also begin to build a better future and lift up those around them. But one alarming development that has occurred since the Beijing conference is the so-called feminization of poverty. Now, despite the fact that many women are gaining rights in their societies, are being educated for the first time, are having access to health care, are even being the beneficiaries of microfinance programs, far too many women are stuck in a cycle of poverty from which there is no escape. And what makes the feminization of poverty so tragic is that it hurts far more than just the women themselves. Because when women succeed economically, the benefits do extend, particularly to their children. And that is one way to lift the sights and aspirations and realities of the lives of countless millions of children, by focusing on their mothers. And yet we know that the barriers are formidable. And what we're going to talk about today is how to overcome those barriers. What do we do about the fact that in too many places, still today, in the 21st century, women are denied access to educational opportunities that would give them the skills and training they need to support themselves, to contribute to the family income? What do we do about the fact that women lack access to health care and the means to address debilitating and even lethal conditions like obstetric fistula, a fully treatable condition? And because of their unequal status in far too many places, women experience increased vulnerability to diseases like HIV and malaria. What do we do about the fact that women still lack equality under the law? In many places, they are still prohibited from owning or inheriting property. They don't have many options if their father dies or their husband dies. They own nothing. How do we help overcome that condition of poverty and dependence? And finally, what do we do about the fact that women make up half of the world's population, but in too many places, they can't vote, they can't run for office. The doors to both the political arena and the business arena are effectively closed to them. For example, we know that many microcredit programs work, but why can't we bring them to scale? Why can't we reproduce the best practices? Why can't we convince banks to support microcredit programs where the loan repayment rate is far higher than any other commercial loan transaction in the world? So here today to discuss some of these issues and to hopefully suggest solutions and maybe inspire some of you to think of ways you can take action on behalf of women around the world are the following guests. Rima Nanavati is the director of the Economic and Rural Development of Self-Employed Women's Association in India. She is currently coordinating Sewa's rural development program in 14 districts of Gujarat. Now, there's a lot to say about Rima and about Sewa, but let me just briefly point out that she manages more than $6 million in economic activities, including a federation of 100 cooperatives and a direct marketing outlet for over 12,000 artisans. She was instrumental in launching and now is busily expanding Sewa's Trade Facilitation Center, which is a partnership to try to make sure that these women have broader markets for all of the products that they produce. I visited Sewa several years ago, and I will never forget how impressed I was with what they were doing and how much they had grown, and it is a great example of how to bring self-sufficiency, dignity, pride, and human rights to poor women in India. Please join me and welcome Rima Nanavati. Anne Veneman assumed the leadership of UNICEF on May 1st, 2005, becoming the fifth executive director to lead UNICEF in its 60-year history. Since assuming the position, she has traveled to more than 30 countries, witnessing firsthand the good work that UNICEF is doing. She is coming up with strategies and advocating for UNICEF to advance the Millennium Development Goals by supporting child health and nutrition, quality basic education for boys and girls, access to clean water and sanitation, and to protect children from violence, exploitation, and AIDS. Prior to joining UNICEF, Anne served as the 27th Secretary of the United States Department of Agriculture from 2001 to 2005. And that is a special expertise she brings to this job because so much of the world's agriculture is done by women. Please welcome Anne Veneman. Ajay Banga is Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Citigroup's Global Consumer Group, International Businesses. His responsibilities include all credit card, retail banking, and consumer finance operations across the world. Through his work at Citigroup, he has been involved with a variety of nonprofit organizations dedicated to financial education, microfinance, education, affordable housing, and community development. In 2005, he served on the advisors group to the United Nations International Year of Microcredit. Please welcome Ajay Banga and thank him for the commitment that Citigroup has made. And our final panelist is Dr. Helene Gayle, President and CEO of CARE. She is the first woman and first person of color to lead this premier humanitarian organization in its 60-year history. She joined CARE from the Gates Foundation, where she was director of that organization's HIV, TB, and reproductive health program. Dr. Gayle oversaw a program of approximately $1.5 billion in grants, and under her leadership, the Gates Foundation, as we all know, expanded support for HIV and TB prevention, treatment, and research. Dr. Gayle was also at the National Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for nearly 20 years and served as director of important programs within our government for HIV, sexually transmitted diseases, and TB prevention. She's an expert on malnutrition in children, and she has been instrumental in evaluating child survival programs in Africa, as well as working on the diseases that take the lives much too early of so many around the world. Please welcome Dr. Gayle. You know, we have this fabulous panel of experts and people who are on the front lines of so many of these issues. And what I hope we can do today is not only hear from each of them, but also figure out what we can do. And I'm going to start with Rima, because for decades, Sewa has been carrying out programs that help women pull themselves out of absolute poverty. And I'd like you to describe for us, Rima, what you have learned from these women about what they want out of life, what their hopes and aspirations are, and what are the challenges, the real life challenges they face in trying to improve their opportunities.
Thank you so much for giving this opportunity to share our work and the lessons that we have been continuously learning from our members. And I say this based on my working with 800,000 members of the Self-Employed Women's Association, SEWA. And the first and the foremost is that women do not want charity. What women really want, based on our two decades of experience and of working with women in Africa, in Latin America, through our grassroots trading network, is women want work. They want work which brings them meaningful, which is meaningful and gainful for them, meaningful in terms of skills, in terms of, you know, bringing them access to, you know, two square meals and security so that they are able to better feed their families, that educate their children. And this work they are able to access only when, you know, we have the women who are organized so that they have their collective strength and bargaining power, and women are able to then have access to assets and capital and have access to institutions that help them access markets and also, you know, basic support services, which is healthcare, childcare, and nutrition. And when all this comes together at a pace, this becomes a tremendous economic opportunity for the women themselves. Even if it is spread over time and duration, women do take control and charge in their fight against poverty. This is the biggest lesson that, you know, we have learned in working with our 800,000 women in this last three decades. Some of the challenges which I would also like to share here is that, you know, when women work on a smaller scale, on small programs, it is fine. You know, women who benefit also feel good, and people who support also feel good. But eventually, it has to go to scale. And going to scale is a big challenge. Because without going to scale, we are not able to change the conditions that, you know, make women and poor, and which also make them more vulnerable. And once women start, you know, gaining economic strength, it does change, you know, the power structure. And once, you know, the power structure starts changing, I think the social and the existing socioeconomic structures feel threatened. And I think no matter how much women then continue working, you know, they do not move far ahead out of poverty, because it is these power structures, you know, the socioeconomic existing structures and the political forces which do not allow the poor and their organizations to really go to scale. They really feel threatened about it.
You know, I can remember very well when I was at SEWA, and women were gathered. Some had walked for nearly a day to get to our meeting, and there was this sea of these beautiful faces and these brightly colored saris, and many of the women stood up to share their story with me, and it put into very personal terms how women would say, you know, I was widowed and no one would help me. My mother-in-law was a nightmare. the police were always harassing me. And they could never have made the progress without being brought into association. And I think that's one of the real lessons, is that working individually, woman by woman by woman, is important, and we want everyone to focus on that, but helping to organize women to stand up for their rights when all the women who are part of SEWA were being harassed at the same time by the police in their market stalls, they could stand up and fight back. And I think that's a critical issue that Rima has raised for us. And as someone who is now in charge of really the premier children's group in the world and has worked so hard to understand the strategies we should follow, how can international and national development strategies be better focused on women and children? And why is it so hard to make the case, which every economist who's looked at this has made consistently, if you want to improve the standard of living for a society, focus on the women? And why can't we get that across?
Well, I think it's a very difficult thing to do. We know that women do about 66% of the work in the world. They produce about 50% of the food, and yet they earn 5% of the income and own 1% of the property. So I think there are many strategies that have to be targeted to women. One is, of course, education. And girls' education in particular is absolutely critical if women are going to get ahead. And we know there are many things that keep girls out of school, whether it's the cost. And if a family has girls and boys, they will send the boys to school first. The girls are kept at home to do the chores and fetch water and do a variety of things. And so I think, and there are strategies that do help get girls in school and students in school, whether it's elimination of school fees, helping to pay for uniforms and books and so forth. The second thing I think that's very important is really looking at integrated healthcare approaches that begin with the pregnant mother. Make sure that you're going to have a healthy baby, and then you will help to address the issue of child mortality. And this is part of the whole issue of women in poverty. I think the other thing is that we need to address the issue of laws and how much they protect women. How do we get strong laws on allowing women to inherit wealth, for example, or own property? One of the countries that's really been changing their laws and making a difference is Rwanda. Rwanda right now has the largest percentage of women parliamentarians of anywhere in the world, at about 48 or 49%. This has made a huge difference. They're creating laws against sexual violence, creating laws on inheritance of wealth, and it's really creating a difference. And so I think we need laws against violence against women. We need laws that allow women to have economic opportunity. And I think if we take a multi-pronged strategy toward women, that we can get results.
Well, I think that you have just very articulately and concisely summed up the agenda, because that is exactly what we need to be doing. In order to get that accomplished, however, we need to convince not only governments, but Ajay, I don't mean to put you on the spot, major multinational corporations who do business in so many of these countries around the world to help be a partner in changing the conditions and perhaps even leading by example, you know, giving women economic opportunities, which then can demonstrate, you know, the role that women can play. And I guess my question then would be, you know, what is the role of corporations in providing economic opportunities, and particularly financial services companies that are everywhere in the world?
Well, first of all, it's great to be a man in an all-woman panel. I think there's a message there. There's a message there in the fact that this is not just a women's issue. It is an issue for all of us. I think that's, thank you for that opportunity. I just think it's a big deal. You know, for corporations of all types, whether it's consumer product companies, technology companies, financial services companies, at the end of the day, it is in their enlightened self-interest to help educate and get women out of poverty, because that is where their future business will come from. And the moment they get that right and they add to it the power of the pleasure and the pride that their employees get from being associated with a company that understands this, you have a very potent combination for multinationals and financial services companies. So I think it's in our interest to do this. Now, how you can go about doing it is, I think, in three real ways. The usual way is philanthropy. You have foundations. They help either build capacity with institutions of different types, or as an example, in Chile or in Venezuela, we have our foundation at Citigroup that helps to get women, along with another foundation locally, get educated on beekeeping, cheese making, organic farming. And along with that, we bring the financial literacy side of it so they know what to do with the money that they generate from these activities. That's the traditional methodology. Another methodology is employee volunteerism. A company like ours that has 350,000 employees worldwide, if you can get even 15,000 of them to devote a day every year to going to help what they bring knowledge and expertise on, you're bringing 15,000 man days of educated manpower to the table to help people. So that's the second piece. But I think the third most important piece is making it sustainable and scalable, to your point, to Rima's point, and that's the business side of this. I think there you can bring resources, you can bring innovation and the like, but I think in financial services companies, there are four clear things you can do. You can help other institutions get liquidity on their balance sheets, and that's a bit like the $100 million fund you referred to earlier. We did something like that for BRAC in Bangladesh, where we helped securitize their loans. It's a $100 loan. There wasn't a real market for securitizations. We got that done. They get $15 million of liquidity every 6 months. We've committed $180 million in 6 years. That allows them to lend further with that liquidity. So that's one kind of help. Another kind of help is insurance. You talked about women not having being left off without dependents. Well, in Mexico, our Mexican business has recently, with Compar Thomas, launched an insurance effort where in this year and a half, we have insured 600,000 women for a $1,300 life insurance benefit. That is 12% of the entire insured population in the country of Mexico, right, through one effort with collaboration with a very strong NGO. And what happens then is that they're not dependent on their families or on somebody else when bad things happen in the family. And by the way, mother-in-laws are a problem for men and women. And the last piece is what we can do directly, and that's by lending. You talked about getting us to lend. And in fact, with the effort and the help of organizations like SEVA, with whom we've been partners for some years, and now with the Working Women's Forum in India, we're actually learning how to lend to these individuals through them. And it's small ticket sizes loans, but we've made 27,000 loans in a year. Our repayments are terrific, 99.2%. And so you learn from that. So I think those are the kinds of things you can do. You can do things, volunteerism, you can do things with the foundation, but even more importantly, what we have to do is to get the business of microfinance becoming sustainable in itself, whether through lending, whether through direct participation, through savings schemes, or as Alan keeps reminding us the other day, whether through equity, which I think is an issue we should talk about when we talk about challenges, but we get there.
Well, it's music to my ears hearing you speak, because I've worked in microcredit since 1983 when Bill and I first met our dear friend Mohammed Yunus and learned about what he was doing with the Grameen Bank and brought an American version of that to Arkansas. So it's been an area of great interest to me, and I appreciate so much what you just said, because there is a role for commercial lenders to get into this arena and to work hand in hand with the organizations like SEWA and others who actually do the work. But it's taken a long time to persuade people of that, and I really appreciate your strong endorsement of that, Ajay. Helene, you have probably the broadest view of any of us because of the work you've done at CDC, the work you are now doing at CARE. How would you describe the opportunities and particularly the challenges facing women as they try to obtain the tools they need for their own self-sufficiency and secure a better future?
Well, first of all, let me, along with the other panelists who have already thanked you and your husband for having this panel. I think this is incredibly important that we have a panel that's really focused on these issues. And my only suggestion is that it's the first panel next time and leads the conference, because I think, you know, we continue to talk about the fact that the most efficient way to break the cycle of poverty is investing in women. And so I think if we really believe that, we've got to get women on the agenda front and center and really think about including girls and adolescents as well, because, you know, we talk a lot about the issues of women, and when we're doing that, we're looking at fixing things that are in some ways already broken. But I think we have the real opportunity. I'm a public health and a prevention person, so I think about prevention. And I think, you know, when we think about how we can have an impact long term, it's really by impacting young girls and their male counterparts, young boys, and making sure that they see the world differently. So one, I think, looking at how do we grow up the next generation of our future leaders who see the world very differently. And, you know, around the world, there are incredible programs, not only in education specifically, but education that includes gender aspects in it. And that when we say gender, we often think women. No, it must be that we also think about our boys and how they're thinking about young girls and the roles in society. So I think that's a critical piece. But then I think looking at all of these things, all of the issues that have been raised, and recognizing that they're all interconnected, and that you know, we talk a lot about microfinance. Wonderful, it's great, but microfinance on its own is not the answer. And in fact, the work that SEWA's doing shows that it's microfinance plus that includes gender equity issues, empowerment, teaching people, women, about their civic responsibility, integrating health into that, integrating information about livelihood and markets and all of that. So, you know, we've got to make sure that whatever we do, the metric is not just how well do people repay loans, but how well are we empowering women. And if we're only measuring the loan repayment, which I think is obviously wonderful, we're all thrilled that, you know, 90%+ of loans that women take out are repaid. But we've also got to start developing metrics that look at what does that do for women's decision-making within the home, and are we putting the kind of components into that that do shift that equation? So I think, you know, looking at this in a more integrated fashion, and the things that we're talking about, education, health, microfinance, agriculture, as Anne mentioned, you know, most of the world farmer, 80% of the world's farmers in Africa are women. And we don't think about our agriculture programs as women's programs and think about what does it mean to really make sure that the small farmers in Africa who are women are actually getting access to markets. So again, all of these things I think have to be integrated when we think about these. And obviously for me as a health person, you know, I think that the role that health plays in development broadly, but particularly for women, women bear a disproportionate burden of illness in many developing societies. And it's both because of their biology, but it's also the interaction of society and culture. So young girls are more vulnerable to HIV because of their biology, but they're also more vulnerable to HIV because of the social pressures, of the economic dependencies. And so we have to think about how do we make sure that we don't just provide public health services, but we also look at the underlying causes of these issues and really do a better job of integrating. And I think our scale-up will be enhanced by having integrated programs as well, as opposed to attacking these things one by one. But wherever we enter, we end up having a cascade effect, because if we help women have smaller families, they're able to educate their children, they have less disease, and all of these things become multiplier factors. So I think that's where our real potential is.
But let me ask you, Helene, to follow up on that, because it is clear that there are so many cultural barriers to what we're talking about. You know, once you start intervening in a way that empowers a woman, that gives women the, you know, confidence to say no to a range of difficult situations. Once you begin to try to work on lifting up women in some societies, you immediately get a backlash from a number of the governmental and economic power structures. So I'd like each of you to respond. How best do we deal with that? Because, you know, it's not that we haven't done interventions over the last 30 or 40 years, but a lot of them have failed, or at least they haven't resulted in the progress that one would have expected. So how can we do a better job of taking that integrated approach and creating real change?
Well, I think first it has to be multi-level. And, you know, we're just starting to bring the community into this dialogue, and we've looked at it only from the policy level. We've got to keep looking at it from the policy makers and the leaders level. But once we bring community in and make them realize that they can make their governments accountable, they can make their policymakers accountable, I think you start a very different dialogue. And so, you know, again, I go around the world and look at some of the projects that we're involved in, that may be microfinance projects, that may be health projects, but a component of that is civic education. And as both of you were mentioning, bringing women into association is so empowering. And so women come into association to start microfinance, but they start talking about their problems, and they start talking about the issues that face them. And then they start, just like any of us, if we're put together and start discussing our problems, we start coming up with solutions. And if you help them recognize how they can make their society more accountable to them, then I think that starts a chain reaction. But I also think in this equation, we've got to include men. And we have to make sure that in again, using the example of the microfinance, where so many of the programs are targeted to women, it does sometimes engender conflict within the home. We've got to bring men into these programs as well, so that women and their male partners see this as a partnership and not see this as something that they have to feel threatened by, and that they see that it's contributing to the family overall. But it's possible, and with the right kind of dialogue, it does happen. So bringing the community into it while we're also looking at the policy level.
Well, Anne, I'd love for you to share with us some ideas about how to help on agriculture, since you have a double expertise here. And given the fact that so much of agriculture is not only run by women, but it's subsistence agriculture, which makes it even more challenging, what could we do? How best could we target resources and opportunities to help in that area?
Well, I think there's a number of things that can assist with agriculture to help not only subsistence farmers, but farmers throughout the developing world. One, of course, is to make sure that they have access to seed varieties, research, and so forth. We saw recently, when I was in Kenya, I saw huge increases in production just by using modern seed varieties that gave greater productivity to farmers. So one thing would be giving farmers access to seeds and fertilizers to increase productivity. The second thing, of course, is looking at new technologies. How do you find the drought-resistant cassava or the disease-resistant maize that is the African variety, for example? So I think that we need to continually target research. I've seen in my travels a breakdown of extension systems in Africa. I think we need to do some of that basic education. And, of course, then there are markets. One of the most disturbing things is the breakdown of the Doha Development Agenda. And these trade talks constantly break down over the issue of agriculture and agriculture subsidies and agriculture access. And so I think we have to, as a global community, address the issue of international trade to provide markets for more farmers.
Well, Ajay, as you were finishing up your opening comments, which I really appreciated because it covered so much, you said there were a few more things you'd like to bring up in order to zero in on what are the obstacles, how do we overcome them, and frankly, how do we persuade more people to see the world as you see it right now with a new market out there to be developed?
I think the part about persuading more people, first of all, is things like this, which get people to understand and make publicity, make the aspect of knowing about this a weapon in itself. I think that's just a big event. But I think the piece about getting public-private partnerships, getting regulators, governments, multilateral institutions, as well as companies together around this whole aspect of economic opportunity is a big deal. I maintain that the best way to remove poverty is to give somebody a job. Everything else comes afterward. And if you can give them a job, whether because they are working for somebody or whether because they're working for themselves, selling vegetables or selling fish or doing something that allows them to go home and not be economically dependent on the other individuals in the family, I think that makes a big difference. And so, in my view, the public-private kind of partnerships have certain challenges. One of them is, in the United States, if you want to know about a certain segment of population, you can get information about what people do, what time they go to sleep, what time they wake up, what they watch, what they don't do, instantaneously. Your ability to create programs that completely understand those people is much better. In most of these countries we're talking about, there is no information. There is no knowledge. So it's a bit of a hit and a run kind of testing methodology. And while testing is good, if multilateral agencies were to spend money and effort on getting that depth of knowledge in some of these countries about what women in that strata of society could benefit from, I think it would help commercial enterprises enormously. So that would be one piece. I think the second big piece is that regulatory agencies and governments have got to provide a framework by which microfinance gets developed, or microcredit, or microinsurance, and all these things get developed within a positive way of being perceived. Because there will be people who will do wrong things. And if one bad thing happens, this entire industry and effort will get set back 20 years. And so it's important to create a framework by which people do these things in a responsible, self-controlled way. I think that's the responsibility of governments and regulators in these countries, in addition to providing a level playing field, which I think they can really do a lot on. And the third part is the aspect of scale, and we've all talked about scale, and you raised it right at the beginning. Why don't we have scale in this business? It's because the cost of reaching people in highly distributed places with a frequent visit is very expensive, with a very small ticket size loan. And you add to that the fact that probably they would not want to come to Citibank to take a loan, because they don't know who the heck I am, and they think I'm some big, bad bank from the United States. And to change that, I need to have a partner who has credibility with these people. And therefore, we need to invest in building the capability of those partners, because those partners never have the adequate, let's say, depth of talent, capability, and resources that allow them to be partners with commercial enterprises. I think that's the kind of three or four scale issues that I can feel around here. And I think I would be mistaken if I didn't say two other things. One is, I think the aspect that Alan Petrikov, like, I'm going to keep raising this. He raised this with me two nights ago about getting into equity for these people as against only lending. It is a huge challenge, but I think we need to apply our minds to it. And I think the second aspect of this is that we've got to get to the stage where the publicity, as I said at the beginning, the championing of this cause by people who can make a difference is just enormously important. Those are my...
Well, I appreciate your raising again the issue of equity, and Alan is in the front row, and he's been deeply enmeshed in trying to figure out the best ways of doing that. That requires that people own something, and that requires that a lot of governments and a lot of, you know, social structures that have been around for a very long time begin to realize that everybody could do better if you gave title to property, if you didn't treat people in the 21st century like they were feudal serfs, you know, in the 8th century. And so I think anything we can do to convince governments and, frankly, the elite of a lot of these countries that it is in their long-term interest to break up some of these culturally embedded obstacles is one way we can actually do what you're saying. Because if people don't own anything, it is very hard for them to figure out how they have any equity, and equally difficult for someone to come in and identify that. Rima, you have had decades of experience on these issues, and I wish that you would perhaps challenge all of us as to what you see as your needs. You know, Rima was in my office with Ella Bott, who is the extraordinary creative founder of Sewa, a few months ago, talking about how to take Sewa global. And it was so exciting, because when I was there in the mid-90s, you were still keeping track of everything on, you know, pads of paper. And now you've got computers, and you're thinking about how to, you know, really bring this to a new level. But what did you need us to do to help you make that happen?
I think it's a very critical and also a very relevant point of, you know, to really deliberate on, is to how do you take local to global and global to local. And, you know, that's what the globalization really has to mean, you know, if we all really want to address this whole issue of poverty. And there are two major specific areas. One is for the global businesses that, you know, and I just couldn't believe what Ajay was just saying. And, you know, it felt like as if, you know, things have just everything is happening and there's nothing much to be done now. But I think there are very few people who really understand that, you know, investing in the grassroots organizations, it's not that they need charity, they need safety nets, but you know what it means by investing. They need, you know, investments in building systems and processes. They need investing in technology, which would also, you know, build their capacities to manage, to acquire newer skills. And then also investing in, you know, advocating policy changes. We still, in countries like ours, we don't see, you know, maternity benefit coming to the women or equal wages for women as, you know, they as you know, active contributors to the economy. So I think this is what, you know, the global businesses, you know, build partnerships and make them market ready to, you know, take leaps and bounds in the national as well as in the regional and, you know, global markets. I sometimes we feel scared that, you know, instead of partnering, building partnerships and leveraging, you know, the strengths of the grassroots as well as the businesses, sometimes they take up initiatives which are very parallel and also often perpendicular, you know, and that sort of, you know, inhibits the growth of the grassroots organizations. And I think this is a major caution for the global businesses that, you know, one needs to recognize the grassroots organizations as, you know, valuable investment partners. And I think there are several initiatives, you know, in different countries, in Africa, in India. I think India is taking leaps and bounds, but we all are, you know, doing it in isolation. And if we have, you know, the businesses, the governments, and the grassroots organizations coming together, I think definitely, you know, it is, I think, as our founder always keeps reminding us that, you know, we have to equip the women in their own fight against poverty. It is their march out of poverty at their own pace and as they wish, not the way we really wish it. And I think the second specific issue is about the policies. You know, I think the first and the foremost is that the policymakers really need to recognize that, you know, women and poor are workers. They need to be, you know, their organizations need to be recognized as partners for change. You know, it's not that somebody's a recipient and somebody's a giver, but these are partners for change, and how do we build partnerships? Second is to also review what the existing policies have done in terms of impact on the poor and their lives, you know, especially when we talk of women. Because amongst the poor, in countries like ours, women still are the poorest of the poor. And then third and important is that to give them voice and representation. You know, where are the representatives of the poor in the policymaking fora? You know, they still are struggling. So I think these are the major challenges that I think we all have to together deal with.
Yes, Helene. And
in listening to her, you know, we've talked about policymakers generally, but I think it really raises the fact that, we, you know, when we start talking about what are the sectors that need to be involved, obviously the NGO sector and grassroots community groups, the business sector, but the government sector is such an important part, especially when we talk about scalability, because there's one institution within a country that has that responsibility for services and for well-being and for changing policies and making laws. And so I think getting governments on board, and that's both governments like ours, rich nation governments, as well as looking at the policies within governments. And I would love to see our government have a comprehensive bill on women that really looks at how do we develop, provide the kinds of programs and resources that would help SEWA and others be able to scale up their activities, as well as looking at what can governments in those countries be pushed to do that would really give the kind of policy environment that's necessary. Because without that, it just is unrealistic to think that small grassroots organizations can do it on their own. And there really has to be a shift in the policy environment, which means government and public sector to allow some of that to take hold and help work with businesses to develop incentives so businesses see that it's in their interest to get more involved in this as well. So, you know, it's the other missing piece of that partnership, the NGO community, private sector, and I think the role of governments, both rich as well as developing country governments in looking at policies that would really, you know, enhance this.
How do we, though, provide the incentives
you've been in politics, Anne, how do we provide the incentives to convince governments to change? You know, we have now for, 30 years talked about the need to change laws so women can own and inherit property, to participate in the political process, to have representation, to send girls to school, to take care of the health care of women. What do we have to do to persuade governments that this is really in their interest to do this?
More women in government to start with.
That's part of it. But while we're waiting for that, Anne, what do you think?
Well, I actually agree with that. And that's one of the reasons I brought up the Rwanda experience early on, is when you put more women in government, you do see policy change. But I also think, in the meantime, it is incumbent upon all of us who are working in the international arena to bring attention to these issues. So bring attention to the fact that there is a tremendous amount of violence against women. And if countries have rape laws on the books, are they strong enough? Do they protect children enough? And are they enforced? Because some countries have the laws, but they aren't enforced. How do you get the laws that give women equal economic opportunity? I mean, the right to own and inherit property, again, as I talked about before. But if we somehow, when I visit these countries, sometimes I feel like people think there's nothing that can be done, so we just won't talk about it. And if we don't raise these issues and get the press in these countries to raise them and put pressure on policymakers, I don't think we'll see the change. But if we continue to raise the issues, I think we'll have more likelihood of seeing change in these countries where we really need to see a change in law and policy.
Well, I'm glad you raised the question about violence against women, because also here with us today is Madeleine Albright. And as Secretary of State, she took an incredible strong position, the first ever, against violence against women, and famously said that violence against women is not cultural, it's criminal. And I really want to commend her for being such a strong spokesperson for this. There are good examples around the world about what does work. We don't want to paint too gloomy a picture, although the increase in violence, having women now be with their children, the principal victims of war, the sex trafficking that goes on. I mean, there's lots of, very dire actions happening that are quite troubling. But there are good examples. But what we've got to do is create more of a connection between what works and people who are willing to support what works, whether they be in government, in the private sector, or in the NGO community. And there are, I was thinking, after I had been at SEWA, I was in Nicaragua, and I was meeting with a group of women in a small microcredit organization. They had seen me on television with the women in India, and they wanted to know all about the women in India. And there was this wonderful moment that, through the pictures that were beamed from India to Nicaragua, there was a sense of, solidarity, that we can do this. But what has not yet happened, and to go back to, the points that Helene and Anne were making, is how do we create a structure that really channels government aid, channels, charitable assistance, channels business efforts, so that we have a better chance of success? Individually, a lot of these programs are very worthy, but how do we create more of an, impetus behind combined efforts to make this happen? And although we're close to running out of time, which I regret, because literally I could talk about this for hours, I wanted to ask each of our panelists, you have an audience of people from all over the world who are obviously interested enough to come to the Clinton Global Initiative to learn about areas of the world and problems, or to wrestle with difficult challenges that they want to do something about. So starting with you, Rima, what would be the one thing you would want to challenge this audience to do to deal with the situation women find themselves in around the world, particularly the economic dependence?
I think the one most important and very relevant thing now, and to what you specifically said, is that what kind of a framework, you know, how do we channel all the different forces to come together? And I think one important step ahead would be to set up a leadership council that promotes, you know, inclusion of women in trade, be it for small farmers, for small producers, for small artisans, you know, for small weavers, for small fisher communities. But we need a leadership council that promotes, you know, inclusion of women in trade, because very often we still see a disconnect, you know, where we think women as small recipients, trade, which only could be discussed, you know, in the corridors of the government buildings with large corporates. But yes, women and trade are very interconnected, you know, and if women have access to trade, they directly feed their children, they run their families, they have, you know, better education, better health care, and all the more important, they work on peace building, and that's what everybody needs. So I think, you know, having such a leadership council would be a very major step forward. Thank you.
Excellent idea. You know, Rima and I and SEWA are working to try to help get some of the SEWA members on eBay, because what I found in working on economic development, even in places in New York, is it's difficult for artisans, small businesses, craftspeople to get their markets bigger than just the immediate area in which they live. So I helped to start some groups where we've been facilitating with technical assistance getting these kinds of products on eBay. And I think the idea of a leadership council and looking for ways to get women into trade is really one we'll follow up on. Ajay, how would you try to make this the case to your fellow business leaders that this is an area where they can both do well and do good? You've been very specific in outlining, you know, some of the ways you've gone about it and what more needs to be done. But what one message do you want to leave with people on this?
Oh, and nothing succeeds like success. And I think that if we can, you know, if we can get business leaders to see the value that you get from being seen as associated, like we are, with doing these things, if you can see the value of the change in your business in that country, if you can see that your employees feel better for being there for you, I think you can make a very strong business case. I don't know that the case for business has not been made. I just think it hasn't been propagated strongly enough. So I keep coming back to that issue of being of making this a publicly known and celebrated cause. There's so many little successes around the world. If all the people in this audience went back and looked for those successes in their individual areas and celebrated those and made people aware of them, I tell you, this will be like a snowball rolling downhill. That's where the excitement will come from. Bite-sized chunks, that's what we can do. Because the big issues sometimes will be insurmountable. But bite-sized chunks can make a difference year over year. That's my feeling.
Well, I think that's a very good way of going at it. And I really appreciate the ideas you've shared with us today. This whole concept of insurance among the poor is really important. And I would argue that we could also come up with some health insurance models, which you could use. I don't know whether they would work as for-profit models, but with help from maybe some of the for-profit sector, you could use the payments into those health insurance funds to build up health systems in local areas. And so it becomes sort of more of a self-perpetuating cycle of the system is there, people have access to it and go from there. But I think this needs to be continued. And I don't want to put you on the spot, AJ, but I would love for you to be willing to sponsor such a meeting of other business leaders, maybe at Citigroup, talking about what you've done, bringing others to the table and seeing whether we could take this to the next level. Thank you very much. And Anne, what can we do to help the important work of UNICEF? You know, I remember as a child going around, you know, collecting money at Halloween for UNICEF. Do kids still do that now?
Absolutely. Good. The boxes are ready. You may pick them up. We can probably have them here this afternoon.
And I think that was always important because it made a connection between children in our country and children elsewhere. And I think we need to, you know, reignite that awareness so that people understand what it is UNICEF's doing and how best we can support that work. And what do you want to leave this group thinking about in terms of what you see as your challenges and how best to meet them?
Well, thank you very much for raising the importance of making this connection with particularly young people, but the public generally in developed countries, with what the rest of the world lives like. It is so difficult in our culture to get, especially in the United States, even more than in Europe, I think, to get the word out about how many people are living in such desperate conditions, and especially women and children around the world. And so it's incumbent on all of us to get that message out. UNICEF works in the areas of education, of healthcare, of protection of children. And I think the things that are critical to this work is first of all, that we figure out what works, that we know how to measure those results, and that we know how to scale up interventions we know can and will work. The second thing is that I really believe that we've had a lot of discussion today about this. We have to work in broad, inclusive partnerships so that we're not competing with each other in the developing countries that we're doing work in, so that we're building on each other's strengths, and so that we're producing collective, measurable results for the people we're trying to benefit, and that those will have sustainability over the long term, which makes it very important what you said about creating sustainable models. How do they become self-supporting so that they don't depend on outside help forever, because they won't be sustainable that way. So I think these are all things that collectively, as a community that wants to help the developing world, we have to focus on.
I am so proud that you're leading UNICEF in this new effort and doing such a great job, and we'll look for more ways to support you in that. And finally, Helene, we've been, I think, very polite in our panel. We have been very specific on policy, but you have to feel some level of frustration and, just concern that after all these years, with all of this attention, we're still sitting here having a panel trying to figure out how best to help women and children. Based on all of your experience, what challenge do you want to give us? What message do you want to leave with us? How better can we mobilize people to do what works and to support, good models around the world?
Well, I guess, first of all, we have to believe our own rhetoric. We have to believe that investing in women is really the best way to have an impact on poverty. All the data show it. We say it all the time, but I'm not sure that people honestly believe it. And so I think, for people in this room, all of whom are in very influential positions working in across different sectors, take what you're doing and make sure that you look at the gender and dimension and look at what the issues are for women, whether it's agriculture, whether it's media, whether it's business. Everything that we do in this room has some impact on the lives of women. And so if we think about it that way, and if we start putting measures that ask the question in all of our work, what are we doing that impacts women, we will have a greater impact. There are individual things that people can do. Obviously, they can all go to CARE website, www.care.org, and read about our work on empowering women. But beyond the specific things that people can do, I think really looking at in every sector that you're involved in, ask yourself the question every day, what am I doing that will impact the lives of women? What can I do that will change women's lives? And have that be the lens through which you do your work. So I think if we do that, we'll all come back here next year having really made a substantial impact and really spreading the word to those who work around us. And I think it's us talking to our colleagues, us making sure that our colleagues are thinking about these. So I just think we have tremendous power. It's in our hands to make that difference. So.
And, I want to just emphasize that we're talking about contributions and actions that individuals can take all the way to giant corporations, large NGOs, and governments. And I just want to end with a few brief stories to give you an idea about what does work. There's a wonderful group called the Heifer Project, which some of you may know of, which for many years has provided livestock and poultry to poor families around the world. They end up mostly being women because it's women doing the agricultural work, as Anne reminded us. And then these women use these cows and these goats and these chickens to take milk or cheese or eggs to the market and slowly build up their own economic position. I recently had as an intern in my Senate office a young woman named Beatrice. Beatrice was from Uganda. Her family was the recipient of a goat. That goat enabled the family to send Beatrice to school. Beatrice caught the attention of some Americans who were doing mission work in the area. Beatrice was a smart, active young woman. Beatrice came to the United States to go to prep school, and Beatrice is now in college here in our country. She wants to go back, taking what she's been given, and work on behalf of the people of her family, tribe, and community and nation. It was just one goat, but it led to changing a young woman's life. In Senegal, there's an American woman named Molly Melching, who went to Senegal 30-plus years ago as a Peace Corps volunteer, fell in love with the country and stayed. And she decided to start an NGO just on her own called Tostan. And what she tried to do was to take civic education and democracy building to villages in Senegal. And it took decades. But slowly and surely, people began to get the idea that everyone should have a voice in making decisions for the village. And through a lot of educational work about what was good for the health of girls and women, Tostan was able to persuade one village to cease the practice of genital circumcision for girls. By persuading the elders in the village that it was bad for the health of their daughters. And once that village was convinced, some of the male elders of the village began to walk many miles to other villages to spread the word. And out of that came a grassroots movement to persuade the government of Senegal to change the laws. And now it is moving across Africa, reaching into many different villages in many different countries. So one person really can make a difference. And so there are many opportunities, and one of my hopes is that CGI will have a special place on its website and an ongoing commitment to these issues. And maybe, Helene, next year we'll start off with women's lives and women's futures, because it does make a huge difference. Thank you all very, very much.